As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. It is good to have you listening to us. It's good to be here with you. I'm putting with in air quotes because, you know, it's just a recorded file that you're listening to. But podcasts are weird. Like, they, you know, that's this like oddly intimate format where we're sort of together in a weird way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's great. Great to be together. Matt and Christy are here with me as well. I'm Ben. If this is your first time listening to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, my name is Ben Sternke, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Matt Tebbe and Christy Penley. Nice to have you guys. Nice to see you guys.
Yeah.
It's good to be together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hi, Christy.
Hey. You know, Ben, you were talking, you know how like if you watch TV and you kind of feel like you know the characters on TV?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But you don't.
Right.
You know, like you've never met them anyway. Right. That's how I feel when I listen to other podcasts. Like, I feel like I know different people, and then I realize I've actually never met them.
Yeah. This is
it's even better than TV characters because these are real people.
We're real people.
We're not actors pretending to be Christy.
Well, and my invitation is anybody who comes to Colorado Springs, you like email Gravity and I will meet you for coffee. I want to meet people.
That's true.
Yeah. It was really true. She'll probably invite you to stay at her house for a month.
Yes, that's also true.
I have a guest room.
There's a guest room. That reminds me, Christy. When you said we think we know these people, right? I was thinking like when we were growing up, it was like Ross and Rachel from Friends, you know.
yes.
And then in the last 20 years, it was like Jim and Pam. Like everybody participated in Jim and Pam's romance on The Office, right? I'm wondering if there's other, if there's other. Now, obviously, I think these are like stereotypically white sitcoms, right? But I'm wondering if there's other TV shows where you feel like you know this person and they're like a part of your life because you how much you like them. But can you think of other characters?
Ted Lasso.
Okay.
Ted. There are times where You know, like I had to sub coach my girls' soccer team this fall, like twice. Mm. And right before it was like halftime, my husband like patted me on the back. And he's like, give a lasso pep talk, you know, like it just became like, you know, what could I say that like makes them get inspired?
You actually do channel some lasso, Christy. I will say there's at least two main differences. You have way fewer corny jokes. And
that's good.
And I'm gonna
take that.
Substantially less lip hair.
Yeah, that's true.
Those are two main differences that I can just immediately think of.
You guys.
But you do channel.
You guys, lip hair. Can I just say, my husband went from Movember right into Mo December. I don't even know what you call it. I was like, you guys. I was like, Paul, it's not Movember anymore. Shave it off. Shave it off, please. That's what I'm asking for Christmas, people. Yeah. I'm just asking that my husband goes back to normal face hair, not the mustache.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know?
You're fine with face hair. You just can't be a...
Yeah,
just,
he has like a goatee and stuff, and I'm fine with that. But grow the goatee back to match it is what I need him to do.
Yeah, do you... Christy, do you remember the cartoon Snoopy? Remember Snoopy?
Yeah.
Do you remember Snoopy's brother?
Does he have a mustache?
He lived out in the desert. His name was Spike, and he had this. He had like
I'm looking it up.
Four mustache. Whiskers that hung down like this.
Oh, I totally do know that. Now you say that, that's so funny.
Paul kind of looks like Spike.
See, grow the goatee back, Paul, please.
I think I'm Ted Lasso.
I'm calling him Spike, and he's not going to know why. And then
get him a T-shirt for Christmas with Spike.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, like somebody with facial hair like Jason Sudeikis can pull off like a Ted Lasso kind of Magnum PI kind of mustache.
Oh, such a beautiful lip dragon.
Full. Yeah. You know. but yeah, if you've got wispy facial hair, maybe don't go with the mustache.
Okay, Ted Lasso. So. Ben, do you have one?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about that. I was thinking like the so two things are interesting to me about this. One. Because of like Netflix and streaming and all this like niching of all the TV shows, like we don't have, there's not like broadcast television shows that everybody tunes in for very much anymore. Because, you know, there's all these streaming services. So I found that interesting. I wonder if there's going to be fewer and fewer of those sort of cultural iconic shows.
Yeah, right.
Ted Lasso is one. It has become one. But, you know, like you can't just turn on your TV on Thursday nights. You got to subscribe to Apple, whatever, you know. And so anyway, so I was thinking about that. And then I was also thinking about, I think the length of the like Friends you mentioned and
The Office
have like multiple seasons. So we lived with these characters
10
for,
years,
for
like
years,
a decade,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's remarkable then that Ted Lasso has only been two seasons and already sort of burned himself into our consciousness.
Yeah.
But I would say Parks and Rec, some of the characters from Parks and Rec are ones that are near and dear to my heart. I mean, like almost all of them. Almost all the characters. I just love them all.
Yeah.
They're all my friends.
Yeah. So,
you know, I'm thinking about my wife.
Especially Ron Swanson.
My wife. Ron. Speaking of mustaches, my wife rewatched the show Gilmore Girls. Just she could like enjoy the relationship between mom and daughter, which, you know, is a bit.
Aww.
Yeah, but I think she would say like those two characters, she feels like she knows them. But if I had to pick two that I feel like I know and we'd be friends, probably Walter White from Breaking Bad. And
he seems like a real charmer.
But
real Ted Lasso.
Buster Bluth from Arrested Development. I feel like the three of us would have some sort of caper.
What if we could have a podcast?
There'd be juice.
The three of you.
Juice. Unlimited juice.
Oh, oh gosh. Man. Well, I'm not sure how we actually introduce this podcast now.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's no good segue.
Yeah.
It's the middle of Advent, and we ended up talking about TV shows.
We did.
But we're going to talk. This episode is great with Hillary McBride. She's the real deal, guys.
Yeah.
She knows what she's talking about.
She does. She does. I told her on the recording that I'd been waiting for a book that takes all the things I've been learning about the body and puts it in one place and makes it accessible. And doesn't lose any of its profundity. it doesn't become too simplistic. And so her book, The Wisdom of Your Body, Finding Healing, Wholeness, and Connection Through Embodied Living, is sort of a compendium of all these different aspects of how our body gets ignored or erased or silenced or scripted or storied in ways that are unhelpful, and how we can reclaim our body as a place of knowing, as a place of identity, as a place of spirituality, you know? And so I don't know, I think one of the biggest things that I'm learning right now is the amount of suffering I experience through my lack of embodiment. And anyway, she was really gracious with her time. This is a wonderful book, and yeah, I can't wait to share this interview with y'all.
Yeah, yeah, it was really profound. She really knows what she's talking about, but also just so I don't know, gentle and compassionate. Mm-hmm. That's a quality that when I see it in people, I just more and more I'm like, that's it, that's it, that's what I want. So,
yep.
Yes. One quick blurb before we get into it. If you are not listeners, if you're not signed up for our weekly email, we get send out curated links to articles that we found helpful or interesting for people like you who want to root their life and their leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus. Go ahead and sign up for that. It's at gravityleadership.com/join, and you'll get several emails from us just introducing us to you. And then every Friday, get an email with links and resources and all kinds of good stuff. Mm-hmm. So join us.
Yeah.
We'd love to have you. All right.
All right.
All right. We good to go, guys? Anything else to say?
Hit that, smash that like button. Wait, is that the right subscribe platform?
Yep.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm doing it right.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah, it's all fine. It's all fine. All right. Here's Hillary.
Dr. Hillary McBride, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
I'm so happy to be with you here. Thank you for having me.
You may recognize Hillary's voice. She helped co-host the Liturgist podcasts for several seasons. She's also a licensed therapist, researcher, and a speaker who specializes in embodiment. And that's actually what we're doing today. You've written a book on the body called The Wisdom of Your Body, Finding Healing, Wholeness, and Connection Through Embodied Living. Before we jump into all the swirling thoughts I have and want to hear you on, Hillary, are there other things about you that we could know?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think it's important whenever someone writes a book on something and appears to be an expert, and especially when you have, you know, lots of graduate level training and degrees and credentials and things like that, it's so easy to assume that we know all of the things that we need to know about the something that we're writing about. And I would rather position myself as someone who's really dedicated to learning, but doesn't really know all of the things and doesn't anticipate that I ever could, and hopes to keep reading and keep writing and keep learning. And I wanted to write a book that would inspire people to start the process of doing that in themselves, in their own lives. And so what I want to say about myself and about the writing of this book is I hope it's the beginning of some things. And I hope that we take the things that are interesting for us about the content and take it further and critique it and add more ideas and write more and share more and experience more. And that's certainly something that I want to do. So I am very much in process of learning how to live and really drill all of this down into the fiber of my being. And so want to hopefully relieve myself and relieve anyone of the expectation that I know all of the things about this.
Yes. Isn't that a wonderful relief to not have to be the body PhD expert.
Right. Yeah. And how could you be? Because of the body of all things. I mean, you'll see this when you read the book, for those of you who haven't, and I'm sure that the two of you have encountered this already, all of the different slices that we can take of encountering the body are just so multifaceted. There's so many layers to this. There's theological, sociological, political, psychological, medical, I mean, narrative. There's just all the different ways that this can intersect. So how could any one person be the expert? Certainly not me.
Right. And that comes across in the book, Hillary, the way that you, it's not necessarily a personal travelogue, but you describe, maybe to make a really bad pun that just popped in my head and I don't have time to filter it out, it's sort of an autobiography of like
I love it.
You coming to terms. It's almost like, so I guess maybe the first question here, and this gets at a little bit of how you tell your story. How did we get to a place as human creatures, so estranged and hostile to our own bodies?
Yeah. The way I'll answer that, I have to catch myself because I want to say, look at what the kind of Western white supremacist, highly disembodied philosophical, theological resources are that have impacted us as a culture. But I want to step back and remind myself and all of us as listeners that not all people experience disembodiment across the globe. There is definitely something that happens where the body intersects with different political narratives and different faith traditions and different cultural contexts, which make it easier or harder to be in the body. So I am speaking about a very specific cultural subset in which we have narratives that have predated, you know, our Christian sacred scriptures, that have told us that what matters about being a human is the mind, that what matters about existence is being as close to God and as pure as possible, and thus we need to leave the perils of the flesh, the lusts, the pains, the limitations.
The pleasures.
The pleasures, exactly, right? And those are considered to be problematic often, right? So pleasure has been tainted as this, you know, thing that gets in the way of our purity, spiritual, physical, whatnot. So we have all of these stories. I mean, Plato, Descartes, Gnosticism, I think the narratives about body hierarchies, white supremacy, patriarchy, all of those things go hand in hand, and colonization. And we just kind of don't even realize that that's what's playing out in the background of our lives. And we, as bodies born in this time period, don't have to be taught those specific stories. We're swimming in them. We're swimming in the cultural water of those stories such that we are even born embodied, but we lose that in this culture. It's kind of groomed out of us as we learn how to be good, how to be in control, how to perform being human in the way that is most desirable and most rewarded by our culture. And all of that is playing in the background. But we just think we're growing up. We just think we're becoming adults. We just think we're being the good person, the good Christian.
Yeah, and the way this book is titled, The Wisdom of Your Body, sort of confronts us with maybe the other scripts we have, the danger of our body, the inadequacy of our body, the pain of our body, the exploitation even, or the oppression of our body. You deal with, in each chapter, you deal with a different aspect of where, again, speaking from my social location, which is similar in many ways to yours, the complications between, we could maybe say, our relationship to our bodies. And one of them is, in one of the chapters, you talk about being raised as a Christian or in a Christian home in the church, and some of the complications that created for you as you, in your relationship with your body. Could you talk about that a bit? How did the Christian tradition make it more difficult for you to accept the wisdom of your body?
I think in the context that I was in, because this is certainly not every Christian tradition and this is certainly not every faith tradition, that there was a story about the flesh being antithetical or at odds to what the spirit was doing, that somehow the flesh or being a body compromised the work of God in the world and through me. And that I think I was introduced to a schism, especially we see that in the language, the flesh-spirit dichotomy. You are not of the flesh, you are of the spirit. You are not, essentially don't be your body. because your body gets in the way of what is good and right and what God is doing. And so there's this very explicit, it's not even hidden, and it's really on the nose, these kind of interpretations of scripture that make us think that our body, and like you said already, Matt, the pleasures of the body are something that we need to really control because they are a liability. They need to be subdued in order for us to retain proximity to God. And I don't, as I've been really researching what scripture is actually saying and how to interpret it differently, I had to come to terms with the fact that I had been very angry at the writings of Paul for a very long time because I was standing in opposition to what I had been told Paul said. And what I had been told that Paul said was that your body is bad, and hadn't ever really come to the text myself, not having been trained in hermeneutics or you know, Greek interpretation. I didn't realize that that's probably not actually what Paul was saying all along, but we have, in the faith tradition I grew up in, imposed our cultural values on our scriptural hermeneutic and taken these biases that were given by culture at large and filtered through what is actually happening in scripture to reinforce the ideas that we already had believed. So there's this kind of like layers and layers and layers of undoing that have been happening for me. Like the layer of undoing, no, my body is not bad. And wow, I'm really angry at this scripture that says that. And then another layer of undoing, oh my goodness, I don't think that's actually what scripture was saying. And I think that there's a lot of people who hate the body who are reading that into scripture. Oh, maybe Paul meant something else. And then I think coming around another layer of seeing all of the ways that our faith tradition, that our scripture actually reinforces that the body is good and is part of God's way of being in the world. In fact, we can just simply, very concretely, look at the incarnation as the center of the Christian faith and say, that's pretty good evidence that being a body is important to God's plan in the world.
Right. And it's something God was willing to do and wanted to do out of love to become embodied.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You actually spend some time unpacking what Paul is actually saying with sarks and with spiritual. We won't go into it here, but suffice it to say that it's a helpful reframing, Hillary, because I think these messages, at least in my experience, we absorb them and just operate uncritically out of them. And then some of us, I think rightfully so, in order to get free of them, we, you know, like you said, like eschew Paul and just sort of push him away. But then others of us, like you, are doing the work of retrieval and reclamation that I think helps us then learn how to inhabit the Christian story faithfully in a more healthy way with our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, that's the hope. And I'm not really as skilled as so many others. This is not my area of main discipline, but there are lots of people out there who have been in maybe less accessible ways saying this for a very long time. But this is kind of one of the problems of academia and the way that we, in very head-centered disciplines, disconnect or create chasms between common knowledge and this kind of elitist knowledge, is that people have been saying this for a very, very long time about Paul, but it doesn't really filter down to the lay community. It didn't filter down to me as a person just kind of going to church on Sundays. I had to speak with several people who have PhDs in Pauline theology and read their resources and wade through that to get to this new understanding. Yeah. So like, where are the places that we can make knowledge about scriptural interpretation more accessible for the everyday Bible reader?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is just one small part of your overall project to sort of name the layers of complications or the layers of possibilities of ways we need to affirm connection or reconnect. You talk about trauma. You talk about image. You talk about feelings and the emotion, emotional center of our life. You talk about how our bodies are political, how they are social entities, and they're arranged in hierarchies, and they're coded and scripted to tell a story about power or no power. As you wrote these various chapters, was there one in particular that surprised you or was most important to you personally as you seek to recover the wisdom of your body.
Mm-hmm. This book has been in a series of different forms as a manuscript. And one of them, well, maybe I'll say this a different way. I had written most of the book before I had two very serious car accidents back to back.
Yeah.
And that ended up being a very central focus of the trauma chapter in this book. Because as a trauma clinician, I work and sit with trauma all day long. I have lots of experience and stories from other people and the working with other people that had a kind of an intellectual understanding, but it wasn't really until maybe a couple, 2-3 months before I was to be done the writing of the manuscript of this book that I got in these two very serious car accidents and ended up getting a PTSD diagnosis from one of them. And it was the writing of my personal narrative of the trauma and the working through of the trauma that really shifted in something in me. Because, and this is the way that writing goes when you're writing a book, you write a manuscript, then you get a new idea, you add it in, you send it off to the editor, it comes back, you're a different person because you've had different life experiences, you see it differently, new things have happened. And as I was writing the book, my healing from the trauma was in process. And so every time I was reading that chapter and then writing new elements to it, I was noticing how my body, in response to the reading and writing, was responding differently. So different things based on what I'd written previously would stand out to me and I'd have anxiety just reading it. Or, you know, and down the road, I'd read something that had previously given me anxiety to write or read, and I felt so much compassion for myself. So the fact that there was all of these different fragmented, time-stamped moments of reading and writing and experiencing and healing, and they were all woven into this chapter. When I hold it now in my hands, it feels thicker and richer and more painful and more beautiful than it would ever for the reader, because it, to me, is this catalog of all of the healing work that I did in the process. And of course, this, I think this is what happens when we write, is there's just so much of us in it that the reader will never know. And then there will also conversely be things that people read into the writing that I have no idea about, and it touches them and it resonates with them. And as the writer, I'll have no idea how well it lands or how off it is for them or whatever. But the way that it, you know, really, when I even think about certain parts of that chapter, they take me back to moments in therapy or moments when I felt myself heal or change. It for me will be such an important way of capturing so much healing and pain in a very particular season of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost, you're describing Hillary. It sounds like a process. I don't know. I'm just reflecting on this. Sometimes we think about a book as a collection of ideas, as a very abstract thing, as something of the mind. And it is, you know, a product of, that's what language is. But you're describing a very embodied process of those ideas coming to fruition on the page. And then also describing the fact that those ideas, as other people, other bodies, other people reading them, those ideas are going to interact with their embodied experience in various ways and hit them in new ways. And it's going to kind of refract and expand from that place. And so anyway, that was just an interesting, I don't know, reflection on, at least, especially your experience, your very sort of embodied experience of writing and editing this book.
Absolutely. Like. And this is something that is emerging in the field of cognitive science, but the idea that cognition itself, language itself, is even embodied is really helpful for us for understanding why when we're reading someone else's words and they are staying up here in this kind of cerebral space, we're taking them in through our ocular nerve, they're hitting certain parts in our brain, we're interpreting them, and we have a felt reaction. Or when I am living through something in a body, it changes the words that I write. Like we have thought of cognition as disembodied because that is the way that we in our culture approach most things from a disembodied place. But even the neuroscience now is telling us that cognition itself is a bodily process, which is just so exciting and mind-blowing. And of course, like affirming of all the things that we're talking about here.
Yes.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
I've started seeing a new therapist who practices a kind of therapy called Hakomi.
Hakomi.
Do you know Hakomi?
I do know Hakomi. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a somatic mindfulness kind of, he'll say things to me like, I'm going to say this to you, and then I want you to tell me how you experience it in your body. Mm-hmm. And I think he's working through some of the insights you're talking about, that we aren't, our brains haven't, aren't carried around by this package of meat, but our brain is all throughout our body. Mm-hmm. And we need that. We have to re-recruit and reconcile with not just the, you know, 7.5 inches above our shoulders, but everything. You wrote early on in the book, you write about the lies we believe about our body. Mm-hmm. And I was reminded when I was reading this chapter, Hillary, that I don't know what provoked this for me, but I began to become aware. So most of our listeners know I'm a able-bodied, white, cisgendered man. I don't consider myself attractive, but I also don't have anything about me that our culture scripts as unattractive. So I've really never thought about body image. It's never really been a conscious thing for me. But I started noticing these little stories I told about my body, little microaggressions against my body. Mm. And I had this moment of just, I don't know if it was courage or desperation, but in my journal, I wrote down these little stories I tell. Mm. I went from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, and I had 2.5 pages, Hillary, of like self-recrimination. Uh-huh. That lives in me all the time.
Right.
But I just want to have access to it. Uh-huh. I wonder if you could speak a bit about these scripts or these stories that we have that actually are sort of, I don't know how you describe it. Sometimes I say like they live in our bones or they're in our operating systems. They kind of live up below the waterline of awareness, but then they impact the degree to which we can be at home in ourselves.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I alluded already to the cultural water that we swim in. Like I can't remember where it is, somewhere in the book, I talk about this quote from David Foster Wallace that he uses in a commencement speech where he's introducing the idea of this fish, you know, these two fish that are, they're there chatting with each other. I guess, what do fish do? Blah, blah. They're having a conversation somehow. An older fish swims up and says, "Hey boys, how's the water?" and swims off. And the two fish look at each other and say, "What the hell is water?" We have this substance, cultural substance that we are swimming in that we don't even know is there, because most of the time, like you said, it happens below our kind of conscious awareness. And yet it is woven into all of the interactions that we have, the way that media tells us what is good, the purchase of the products that we kind of enjoy or are driven towards, some of the choices we make around the foods that we eat, the way that we evaluate ourselves, how we present ourselves when we are hoping to be in a romantic connection, the private inner thoughts, the posture. I mean, the number of people that I've worked with in therapy who were taller than their peers growing up, and they stuck out or were had people commented on their body. And so they would hunch their shoulders in photographs or be small so that they didn't stand out in a way that felt painful for them. And then now chronically have postural issues as a result of that, right? Mm-hmm. There's just a million little things that are happening around us that are shaping how we are in our bodies or how hard it is to be in our bodies. And it takes consciousness raising effort. Usually that's interpersonal as well, because it's really hard to see all the things that we can't see. We usually need some help to see some of these things. But when we start to raise consciousness around it and start to engage in media literacy in particular, and we start to see where these stories come from. And again, media is not the problem. Media is the vehicle for communicating broader cultural ideas. So we see it really clearly in media. There is something that becomes really scary about how, like, kind of inoculated we are against the toxicity of all of these things, how many messages we got from an early age before we could think critically, and then how they were just reinforced around us. So one of the things that I don't talk about at length in this book, but I talk about in my first book, Mothers, Daughters, and Body Image, which was my master's research around how narratives of bodies are passed down between women. What we saw is that there's a very particular cultural script that you use to create social proximity, which is one of the main ways of reinforcing some of these narratives about bodies. So Mimi Meekster calls this fat talk. And the idea is that we build closeness and connection, particularly when you're socialized into girlhood and womanhood, by shaming your body. So an example of that would be, you know, two women meet at a coffee shop and they're standing in line, and, you know, it just, I'd be so curious to hear if listeners recognize this dialogue as I'm describing it, but you just imagine you're standing behind two women in a coffee shop and they're bantering, they're catching up, they're about to get something at the till, and someone says, "Oh, that really looks good." And the other person goes, "Oh, you know, I'm bad. I can't, you know, I was bad last night. I had two, you know, extra desserts, so I can't have that. But like, ooh, did you see how many calories are in it?" And, you know, then someone else says like, "Oh, I've been really needing to diet lately because the holidays are coming up," and, you know, all of the things that go into monitoring my diet. And then someone else says, "Oh, but you don't have anything to worry about. You should really see what I've been doing." And we downplay what the other person is saying and shame ourselves so that we put the other person at ease. I mean, there's this whole script that uses diet culture mentality and anti-fat rhetoric to build closeness with other people. We want to make the other person feel better about how they feel bad about their body. And so we put our own body down. And this is like a very obvious version of one of the subtle things that happens on a day-to-day basis between us and other people, where we are constantly evaluating our body in comparison to somebody else. So, I mean, I could go on and on and on about this, but some of those stories are, you know, bodies have to be small to be good, except if you're a man, and then you need to have a body that's big, and but also svelte and kind of sculpted, right? You need to have a body that is sexualized, but not too sexualized, because then you become a problem. Your body becomes a problem. Your body needs to be thin. Right? Your body needs to be able to be good.
Yes.
Right. Your body needs to be white. It needs to be controlled. There are so many ways. Your body needs to conform to the gender binary, right? That matches the sex that you were assigned at birth. Like, there are just so many ways that this happens. And I think it really can become kind of overwhelming when we start to deconstruct all of the intersecting ideas that pull us away from what I want people to know, what I think is inherently true, which is that all bodies are good. That's it. Just, they're all good, just as they are.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a reality I'd wish on my friends, Hillary, that they would consider the space that they take up, whether they want to or not, as good, and could affirm and embrace and receive that. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you touch on here that I feel the least competent, so Ben and I, we pastor a church together, we lead Gravity together. And one of the areas that we've talked about repeatedly tackling in our church, but we haven't been able to get our hands around how to do it well in a way that doesn't just ruin everybody's lives, is talking about our relationship to our sexuality and our bodies, that our bodies are created to be sexual and sensual. And a lot of people get various messages about their sexuality, about their gender, their their sensuality, and how their body connects to that. You reference in the book kind of having to recover a bit from the story you learned in church about sexuality and your body, and having to reconstruct maybe a more livable, faithful way of inhabiting your body as a creature who has sensuality and sexuality, and not have to deny or repress that. Could you maybe give us a bit of guideposts on that journey? Like, what was that like for you, and how have you navigated that as not just a therapist, but as, like, you know, a woman?
Yeah. Two things really stand out for me. One of them is having grown up in purity culture, and I would say because I had therapist parents who were critical thinkers, that there wasn't the same kind of rigidity and shame that I know some people experience, although that purity culture narratives were very much a part of the faith community that I was in. I got to university and I went to a Christian university. So there was lots of conversation in the college age crowd about how to navigate these sexual tensions. And I remember having kind of a light bulb moment where many of my peers had been reading, you know, the Joshua Harris book, the Kiss Dating Goodbye, all of the things that suggested abstinence until marriage would equal extraordinarily fulfilling sexual encounters, which of course had to be heterosexual and had to be monogamous, and they had to be kind of within the confines of marriage. So I remember having this awareness that it didn't make sense that we would say some part of our interaction with someone that we love is bad, and then there would be this wedding, there would be a ceremony, you would have a party, and then you would have intercourse, and it would be satisfying when you had no prior experience, when something was totally new for you, when you were new to each other in that way, and that it would be the most satisfying encounter of your life. Like, there's just no way that that makes sense in any other domain of our life. So, you know, if I'm going to, you know, never have a vulnerable conversation with someone where I disclose something painful about myself, and then I do it on the biggest night of my life, knowing that everybody knows that's going to happen, and then I tell them everything about my life, and I let them into this most painful experience of my life, and they have no idea because they've never talked about vulnerable things too, that it's going to go well. Like, we know reasonably if we take another facet of the human experience and we map it onto, or we map the ideas we've had about sexual purity onto the other domains, it doesn't translate. It's just unhealthy. It's bizarre. It doesn't make sense. And so I started to really think, wait a second. I think that we set ourselves up for shame. And then, I mean, another part of that was why, no wonder it's hard for people after getting married and having sex for the first time to feel like that's painful, or it's uncomfortable, or they feel insecure in themselves because they have no experience. You can't just say something is bad, 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 therefore save it for the person you love. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Why would they want it?
And why would it be enjoyable? Why would you all of a sudden be able to relax into it? And we know from kind of our systems of understanding sexual arousal and what's happening physiologically in the body around sexuality that you need activation. You need to be able to lean into something at the same time as you feel at ease in your body for sexuality to be an experience that is pleasurable. If there is a shutting down that's happening because of, you know, a particular nerve branch that says, this is bad, make it go away. Like, the shutting down inhibits your ability to feel arousal, and arousal is a really important part of pleasure and enjoyment and a kind of proximity seeking behavior. So these things of, like, shut it down and it has to be perfect in no way make for positive sexual experiences. And then I think if we add to that, another experience that I had was realizing in sexual activity with my partner that I was getting experiences of my body that were pleasurable in such a way that made me realize my body was good, that my body was not this place that just held trauma, that just held shame, that just held insecurity, that my body actually, in this very innate, wordless way, wanted to experience these wonderful sensations and wanted to share them with somebody. And it was part of the sharing with somebody and the uncovering of what pleasure could be like in my body that was actually part of my healing from an eating disorder. Because my body up until that point had been this thing that I needed to control and make go away. And then all of a sudden, my sexual activity was a route back in to know maybe my body is also part of enjoying being alive. And so there are lots of people who have eating disorders who really struggle with sexual activity because sexuality is embodied. That's it. Yes. Full stop. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And to be in an eating disorder is to be very disembodied and controlling of the body, even though we're obsessed with the body. It's a kind of disembodied, fragmented obsession. But for me, those two experiences, one in college and then one having sexual experiences, were a really part of the reorganizing of saying, well, maybe if I believe that my body was created by God and is good, and that my body is part of creation, then maybe my sexuality is good too. And maybe I need to start rethinking some of these ideas that I had.
Yeah. Yeah. There's almost this, you mentioned this strategy of controlling our bodies, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's keeping food from it or staying abstinent from sexual activity as a way to overcome it. To maybe even try to become transbodied, meaning a separate above, rise above it, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is a strong stream in the Christian tradition that the body is something to overcome. Mm-hmm. But in this book too, you sort of draw us back into the Christian tradition. We've already talked about this and saying that that's not the only thing the Christian tradition has to say about the body. But then maybe as we get closer to the end here, I wonder for many of us, like facing and befriending our bodies is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's we've experienced mm-hmm. trauma there or deep shame there or, social scripts teach us to hate or mistrust or want to get rid of our bodies. And in this book, one of the powerful things we haven't talked about is that you, in every chapter, give us accessible practices to be reintroduced to our bodies, to sort of to reacclimate to our space and being in the world. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe give us some hope? Like, why are practices important to begin to reclaim our body as sacred and the mm-hmm. wisdom that's there? And how does that actually help us? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. It would be so nice if I could give people an intellectual map of becoming embodied and that would be enough. But the irony or the beauty of this is that our body is asking us to be in experience, not just in ideas. Our body is the kind of always available to us through sensation, through the present moment, through encounters with our sensuality in some way. And it's not, I might even go so far as to say, I don't think it's enough to just think differently about our body. That isn't necessarily going to be what helps us inhabit ourselves. It's going to be having experiences. But sometimes we don't know how to do that because we've gotten so disconnected from ourselves that maybe we can change our ideas about the body, but we don't know how to translate that down into a felt lived reality. So these are like... Sometimes those like questions that people ask on first dates, the practical or experiential equivalent of that, like date yourself, date your body again, like get to know yourself by trying some of these experiments, try noticing what happens when you do this, try noticing what happens when you do this. And here in my language, I say try and noticing, right? There is something very important about thinking about this as an experiment that doesn't have to go perfectly, and then seeing what happens and getting to know yourself through these little experiments in such a way that you aren't just practicing something, but you are becoming more of yourself because you are getting data about who you are and what's hard for you and what you like as you dip into these experiments. So my hope is that, again, like I mentioned actually when we started, that this is not just a thing that lives in the page. The book is not just a thing that lives in the pages of the book, but becomes a way that you reconnect to yourself as the reader by coming home to your body. And hopefully these exercises will be gentle invitations to do that.
Yeah. Speaking of gentle invitations, one of the practices that impacted me greatly was you have this, you invite us to gently touch a place on your body and thank that part of your body. And I, honestly, I wept, Hillary. Like, I wept because of, first of all, sort of my, there's a baseline sort of, this is cheesy kind of repulsion. Like, to talk to my body and be kind to it. Like, there's some kind of toxic something in me that that feels like, I hope nobody sees this.
Yeah.
But then another layer is, why have I never done that before? And why is there so much resistance? And then why, when I do it, do I feel so vulnerable? You know? And there are dozens of exercises or practices like this through the book that actually arrest us. They help us confront the disenchantment with our body, the disembodiment with our body. And I think it's an undiscovered country. Like, we don't even know what we're missing.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You said that so well, especially when we've learned to live without full connection to ourselves and have actually been rewarded for that. It can be surprising to us to realize that there is a kind of cultural disobedience that has to happen as we come back into our body, but it takes us into more fullness, that there was even more that we didn't know that was there that we didn't experience.
Yes, we are transgressing some cultural scripture when we get embodied for Western white people. Hillary, I told you before we hit record, I think every chapter could be a book on its own. And in fact, I've been chasing books in these various chapters, trying to piece together, why do I hate my body so much? And what do I do about it? And I've been looking for your book for 10 years and it's a beautiful gift. I think if enough people take what you've written seriously and put it into practice, like, we could actually change the world. Things could change. Where can people find you, Hillary, if they want to connect with you, maybe online or other places? Where are you hanging out?
Sure. On Instagram, Hillary Leanna McBride. On Twitter, Hillary L. McBride. And then my website, HillaryLMcBride.com. But thank you so much, Matt, for saying all of that. I really appreciate it.
Yes. Hillary, it was great to have you with us. Great to be able to connect about your book today. And we'll put all that stuff in the show notes. It's really great. Thank you for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome. And Matt, I should add, I don't know if anyone, if you have seen, I'm sure you've seen it because you sound thorough as a reader, but there are lots of references in the back of the book, things that I pulled from, but also places that people can go when they want even more resources. So every chapter, I think, has maybe 10 to 15 different books that you could go read if you wanted to read more about that topic. Lots more reading to do.
Yes, I've been circling them. Thanks, Hillary.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.